Thanks for all the introductions. We will proceed to calling the second case, 00-8246-CR, State v. Multala. We'll hear first from Attorney Jeffrey W. Jensen, who is representing the defendant, James E. Multala. Counsel?
If it pleases the court, I am Attorney Jeffrey Jensen, and I represent the defendant, appellant, petitioner, James Multala in this case. The issues presented to the court, although stated in some detail in the briefs, can be better stated, I think, in a nutshell form. And the first issue presents a Fourth Amendment search warrant issue, and the question there is whether this 86-paragraph affidavit submitted in support of the application for the search warrant establishes probable cause in several things. Firstly, whether Mr. Multala was the person who killed these young women. Secondly, probable cause to believe that Mr. Multala not only killed these women, but that he was a serial killer, and that becomes important later on. Thirdly, if Mr. Multala is the one who killed these women, and if he is a serial killer, that under the circumstances stated in the affidavit, it is likely that these small items of personal property, BB-sized earrings, Mickey Mouse watches, and things of that nature, are likely to still be in his home some 20 years after the murders took place. The second issue concerns multiplicity of the complaint. The complaint, if I'm recalling correctly, had some 70 counts against Mr. Multala, alleging the possession of child pornography charge. And the nutshell issue on that point is whether the legislature intended to permit the prosecutor to charge an additional count for each image. And the conclusion I'm asking the court to reach on each of these is, first of all, that there was no probable cause to believe either that Mr. Multala was the killer or that he is a serial killer. But most importantly, there's no probable cause to believe that over 20 years later, these small items of personal property were likely to be found in his Arrow Street address. I'm also asking the court to find that the legislature, based on the plain language of the statute, did not intend to permit the prosecutor to allege a separate count for each image portraying child pornography. The facts in the affidavit can be summarized as follows. In the early to middle 1970s, four young women were found dead in the Racine and Milwaukee area. In two of the cases, the shirts of the women were pushed up over their breasts, and in two of the cases there was evidence that the cause of death was strangulation by ligature. In other words, some sort of a rope or other sort of a ligature was used to strangle them to death. Other than the fact that the clothing was pushed up over the breasts, there was no direct evidence that these women were sexually assaulted. About this time, in around 1974, James Multala was arrested. He was arrested when he pulled over a young woman on I-94 in Milwaukee County by speaking through a loudspeaker in his car, representing himself to be a state police officer. The young woman pulled over, and she was put in handcuffs by Multala and taken to her car, and she saved herself by telling Multala to turn off the lights in her car, and when he left, she drove away, found a police officer. Multala was arrested. And there are some allegations, or there's some representations in the affidavit, that as a result of this arrest and conviction, he was put into the Central State Mental Hospital, which I think actually had the name for the criminally insane at the time he was put there. It's represented in the affidavit that the strangulation killings at that point stopped. There's evidence in the affidavit that Multala showed a fairly unusual interest in these cases, in that when he was arrested, and it was reported in the newspaper that he was arrested for this Whitaker incident, a note was sent to the Milwaukee County District Attorney saying that this person, meaning the person arrested in the Whitaker case, was the Southside Strangler, and that he had raped 36 women. The handwriting was analyzed and determined to be Mal Taylor's handwriting. He also contacted some of the television stations in Milwaukee and requested videotapes of any coverage that they had concerning the cases. And the last sort of information that's set forth in the, or the second to the last sort of information set forth in the affidavit, is that Mal Taylor had some unusual sexual proclivities, in the sense that he was not able to become sexually aroused unless he put his fingers on the neck of his partner until to the point that she became weak and in some cases unconscious. And all of this evidence was wrapped up by the investigator, a detective or Officer Hanrahan, by saying that he had attended a number of symposia concerning serial killers, and that he had read a number of books on the topic, and that he felt himself to be qualified as an expert in the area of serial killers. And he represented in this affidavit that serial killers tend to remove items, small items of personal property from their victims, and that even under intense police scrutiny, and even after long periods of time, serial killers tend to hang on to these items because they fuel the fantasy. And the investigator Hanrahan also represented that serial killers tend to have an unusual interest in their cases, to the point where they, in effect, taunt the investigators during the course of the investigation. Significantly, and this becomes significant later on in my remarks, Officer Hanrahan represented that he read these books, that he attended these symposia, but he doesn't attribute any of those opinions, what have been referred to in the briefs as the mementos opinion. And so evidently, based on the allegations in the affidavit, those were his own opinions. And that becomes important. Now, whether there was probable cause to believe that Mal Taylor killed the women, I think the answer to that is no. And the primary reason is that he was intensely scrutinized by police at the time that these were happening, and he was not arrested. Now, there's been some discussion back and forth in the briefs over whether there's some different standard of probable cause to arrest a person as opposed to probable cause to search their home. And I think the only difference is that probable cause to arrest requires that there be sufficient facts to create probable cause that the person committed a crime, whereas probable cause to search requires that there be sufficient facts to believe that a certain item will be in a certain location. And in the logical, in the syllogism required to reach the conclusion that Mal Taylor may have had these personal items, it is required to believe, at least to the level of probable cause, that he was the one who committed these murders. And we know he hasn't been arrested. That fact aside, maybe that could be attributed to a discretionary decision by a prosecutor or even police. But that aside, there is nothing, no fact, connecting Mal Taylor to any of these murders. We know that he has unusual proclivities. We know that he has an interest in the case.
Didn't he indicate that he had been with one of the four women?
There was a comment made, I believe, to a physician or some sort of a psychologist at the Central State Hospital that he had been with one of the women on the night that she disappeared. Yes, there was a comment.
Didn't he indicate that there was a possibility that he had killed her?
Well, I think the exact way that conversation went, at least the way it was represented in the affidavit, was that he could not remember the course of events after he had picked her up. And the way I read it was seemed to be that it was suggested to him that he must have killed her then. And he said, well, I can't remember. I guess it's possible. If I was the last one with her, I must have. That's the way I think the conversation went. But I think it's also important to consider that this was made in the course of treatment at a mental hospital. And I'm not even concerned so much with the privileged nature of the communication as I am with the fact that people are treated in these hospitals because they have a very tenuous grasp on reality. And I think although we don't get into a credibility determination in an affidavit or any kind of a probable cause determination, I think we do get into a reliability determination. And in my opinion, a comment under those circumstances in response to what was apparently a leading question, that evidence is that fact is not reliable.
Well, counsel, you're in the same area. He also described correctly the shoes that victim or woman was wearing that evening, even though the general information, according to the missing persons material, described them as a different as sandals.
Right. The missing persons report provided by, I think, the victim's mother said that she was wearing sandals, and Mr. Maltaylor said that she was, in fact, wearing shoes, which was corroborated by the police investigation. And I would have to check the affidavit to make sure, but I think that refers to the girl that he admitted to being with. And so I don't think that adds anything to his comment that he had been with her on the night that she disappeared. It simply corroborates the fact that he was with her. I don't think it goes any further than that to suggest that he was the killer.
Mr. Jansen, yes. Doesn't the case law make it pretty clear that we're supposed to give real deference to the determination of probable cause made by an examining magistrate? How do you get around that case law here? And don't we have to look at this in the light of the totality of the entire affidavit in support of the request for search warrant?
In response to the first question, is a level of deference to be accorded to the issuing magistrate? And the answer to that question is yes, because granting deference to the issuing magistrate encourages police officers to get search warrants as opposed to taking this upon themselves to search wherever they please. I'm not sure that the cases describe in any great detail the level of deference, and I would suggest that the level of deference shouldn't extend beyond granting credence to any inferences that the issuing magistrate might be able to draw from the affidavit. In other words, sort of like a probable cause determination at a preliminary hearing, if any reasonable inference supports the conclusion, then there's probable cause. And I think it should be the same sort of deference in this situation, that if an inference can be drawn from this affidavit, which supports the issuance of the warrant, that's the inference that the appellate court's required to draw. I think that's the deference. And the second question concerning the totality of the circumstances, for once, as a defense lawyer, I'm able to stand in front of the court and say, yes, I think the court should look to the totality of the circumstances, because when you look at the totality of the circumstances in this case, I think that's when it becomes perfectly clear that no probable cause exists. Because I'll be the first to admit, reading that Mr. Maltaylor had an interest in these cases and that he described some of the clothing and he had these unusual mental problems, it raises suspicion. But only when you consider the totality of the circumstances, that after his arrest, the murder stopped, but then obviously he had been released from prison for many, many years, they never resumed. When you consider the fact that police did interrogate or police questioned Patricia Maltaylor and the daughter, Trish, concerning Mr. Maltaylor's involvement in here, and none of them mentioned helping him maintain small mementos or anything of that nature.
Isn't there reference to him keeping a scrapbook?
Yes.
And the scrapbook, at least in one witness's memory, containing apparently information in regard to at least one of the deaths of these four young women?
Well, I think what the affidavit alleges is that there was a girlfriend of Mr. Maltaylor's from the 70s, and I can't think of her name right now, but I do recall she was a waitress at some point at a place in Green Lake, Wisconsin, and that they interviewed her, and she said that she knew that Mr. Maltaylor kept a scrapbook, I think she said, of all of these disappearances. And I think that falls into the category of facts that I discussed earlier, that he had an unusual preoccupation with the case. Yes.
As I see or understand your argument, you are arguing that there has to be probable cause to believe he killed one or more of these women. This was a search warrant, right? Not an arrest warrant.
Correct.
Okay. But you argue that there has to be probable cause to believe that he killed her because you need that to then justify the search warrant. So that if there's probable cause to believe he killed her, then you should search his premises because there's probable cause to believe that the killer will have mementos of the killing, so you want to find them. Police want to find them. That's the argument here, right?
Right. But I would add to what the justice just said, not that he killed one of them, but that he killed all of them. Because otherwise, if he's not a serial killer, then there's no reason to believe 20 years later he'll still have the mementos.
Now, so that's the analytical framework of this argument, if I understand it. Lefebvre says that on an arrest warrant, it doesn't matter how stale the information is, because you're looking at historical facts. Was there probable cause to believe that he killed these people? So anything that goes to that, no matter how stale, is okay.
It makes sense to me.
Okay. He also says, but on a search warrant, staleness becomes important because you've got to have probable cause that the material you're looking for is still in that place. So he gives the example of a marijuana cigarette. It's not going to be there in 2 months. Especially if this is a place that has a cleaning service every night. On the other hand, if it's records of a business, which are retained under the ordinary course of business, doesn't matter if it's a little stale. And he cites various cases, and I don't know that any of the cases he cites deal with 20 years, but that's neither here nor there because the exact time is not relevant. You have to look at the nature of the crime. Okay. Do we agree so far?
We do agree so far.
Now, I want to know what is in the affidavit that was not available, information that was not available 20 years ago or 15 years ago. And I know that this is a fresh look, but I want to know, is there any new evidence? And I'm especially, what about the DNA evidence?
My understanding of the way this investigation proceeded is limited to what's in the affidavit. And my reading of this affidavit is that none of the facts, all of the facts, were available to police in the 70s at the time that these murders happened. with the exception of what I think was a 1988 interview with Patricia Maltaylor about his proclivities. So as far as I can tell, the most recent fact was from 1988, but the vast majority of the facts were from the early to middle 1970s. The new information, and I hesitate to call it information, but the new spin put on these facts was Officer Hanrahan's training concerning serial killers. The affidavit itself doesn't tell us whether that knowledge or that area of expertise existed in the 1970s or not. And I don't know if it did or it didn't.
What about DNA? Did they find some skin or blood under one of the victim's fingernails?
They did, yes. And I happen to know the results of some of those forensic tests, but they're not in the affidavit. And I believe the DNA analysis was done during the course of this case, and it was found that it was not Maltaylor's DNA. But that's not in the affidavit.
But does the affidavit ask? Well, they wouldn't be looking for a search of the premises for his DNA, I suppose.
No,
they didn't look for that.
That isn't what the search warrant was issued for. At least it was to search his home.
All right. Now, so you got old material with a fresh look. What's the matter with that? You know, this is a very serious crime, or crimes. There's no statute of limitations on murder, right? What's the matter with taking a fresh look at old evidence?
Well, here's what's the matter with it in this case.
That's right. We have to look at a case because it's a case-by-case analysis,
right,
according to the U.S. Supreme Court.
I think that there probably could be cases where some new learning concerning computers or some kind of technology.
DNA.
But here's what's wrong with it in this case, and there's two things. One thing is, I don't know for sure, but I suspect that this area of expertise existed in the 70s. But even if it didn't, if this is a newly developing area, it's obviously an academic pursuit, like any other academic pursuit. This investigator, Hanrahan, has never investigated, prosecuted, or chased after a serial killer himself. So like I wrote in the reply brief, it's just like me coming before this court and making arguments of law without citation to cases. It'd be like writing a paper concerning any topic in high school and not citing to your authority. We're to believe that these opinions about serial killers came from Officer Hanrahan evidently that's what they did, because he did not cite, for example, according in the Green River case, police discovered that the killer kept mementos.
Well, suppose you had training at a police academy and you have profiles of people. Police use it all the time. And the profile is just what you said, a person who has peculiar sexual proclivities, person who has an unusual interest in the crime, etc.
Well, but this is what's wrong with it. The search warrant has to be scrutinized at some level by the magistrate. And when there's no citation to authority, there's no way for the judge to scrutinize the reliability of this information. And all the police officer has to do is come in and say, I'm an expert in the area of drug trafficking, and in my opinion, drug traffickers keep drugs in their homes.
We have guns and cash, and the court's accepted that. That's what I'm pushing you on. The court has accepted that kind of material.
Where the person has actual expertise, where it's not just a conclusion. My argument is that these opinions, the mementos opinion and other ones, are conclusions without any citation to that.
Well, I have another problem with this, even if I would agree with you on that. And that is, let's just assume that the profile is that they keep it for 20 years. How do we know he lived there? He lived at the address that's searched.
Well, we only know, again, what is in the affidavit, and it's alleged that he lived there in one paragraph for 20 years, which before the trial court was alleged to be a misstatement. But I think reading the whole of the affidavit, it's pretty clear that he didn't live there. So we are free to argue that he was imprisoned or released in a mental hospital for a period of time, which means that it would require the cooperation of his wife or some other person to maintain possession of these small items, and there's no reason to believe it. Probable cause is a common sense, practical determination. And I think we all know from our own lives, hanging on to a small piece of jewelry for 20 years can be difficult. And
how do you get around State versus Mosley, our Court of Appeals case 1992, wherein we adopt the New Hampshire rule that makes the difference between stale information and stale probable cause? That the case goes on to describe that, look, you can have information that's years and years and years old that might be stale information, but you can take old information, combine it with new data, let me add, or new perspective, and create present probable cause. Citations. You know,
right.
That's the law that we've adopted. How do you get around that?
Well, I don't think we need to get around it, because the $64,000 question in this case is whether these baby-sized earrings and Mickey Mouse watch and things like that are likely to be in the Arrow Street address. And I don't think it's important necessarily that the facts in the affidavit are 20-some years old. I think it's the inference that you draw from those old facts based on common sense. It's just not likely that somebody could maintain possession of those items over that length of time without the assistance of somebody, and also without him being a serial killer. And the information making it seem like he is a serial killer is not reliable, because there's no citation to authority, and this person is not an expert in that sense.
Thank you, counsel. You know what? Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Attorney General Sandy Nowak. I do represent the respondent in this case, the people of the state of Wisconsin. I'd like to begin my remarks by telling you first what the state is asking you to find, but secondly, and I think particularly important in this case, what the state is not asking you to find. On the first issue with regard to the search warrant, the state is asking you to find, as the Court of Appeals did, that under the specific circumstances of this case, relying on the facts in this affidavit, that the issuing magistrate had a substantial basis to find a fair probability that evidence would be found at Von Toller's Arrow Street residence in 1998. In doing so, the state would refer you to the rule of law articulated by Justice Bradley in State v. Molloy, but also in State v. Enert, in that timeliness is a totality of the circumstances question, and that you must look not only at that period of years, but at the circumstances underlying the affidavit, including the nature of the crime and the nature of the evidence being sought. The state would also ask this court to conclude, though, as a matter of law, that an expert affidavit attributing certain behavioral patterns to particular groups of criminals may be one factor in probable cause determinations, provided that the state has established a sufficient foundation to make the affidavit relevant. That is, that those behavioral patterns apply to this particular case.
Probable cause for what?
Probable cause to search.
Do you need probable cause to think he committed the crime in order to search that dwelling? You need probable cause to think that that evidence is going to be there. It could be there because he's a conspirator. It could be there for any number of reasons. But one reason is there. It could be just easily, you have probable cause to believe that he is the murderer. What basis do you need?
You don't need a probable cause as a matter of law to establish that he is the murderer. In this particular case, the state is relying on a substantial amount of information that he is in fact the murderer to get that second leg of the analysis, which says that this evidence, which is probably evidence of the crime, is in this location.
You do need to have probable cause that he's the murderer.
Well, I'm not willing to concede that you need probable cause that he's the murderer. I
reasonable suspicion.
Yes.
A hint.
Yes. Some rational basis. A fair probability. All those general...
Sounds like probable cause to me. You don't need much for probable cause.
That's true, you don't. But the state...
Does the state have any duty when... requesting a search warrant to reveal to the magistrate any exculpatory evidence might establish that he was not the murderer? And I ask the question because counsel not only brought up the fingernail scrapings, which apparently the record may have been inappropriate for them to do so. I don't know the state of the record, I haven't read it. But you also raised a question for me in your brief, when you talked about the semen that was found in the vagina. And usually when somebody talks about something like that and then doesn't hook it up, I at least am assuming that it was not Mr. Maltaylor's. Maybe that's a wrong assumption. But is there any duty on the part of the state to bring that to the attention of the magistrate?
I think to the extent that not doing so would create a Franks issue, that is, it would be patently misleading, then I think yes. But I would like to clarify that my reading of the record tells me that the DNA testing was done after this warrant was issued, that it was at that point. And in that case, the state would submit that it's not relevant to this determination at all, because what we're looking at is the four corners of the affidavit as the magistrate saw it.
So at least a perusal of the record, I think, is going to establish for me that this DNA test was done after the application.
Yes, and at any rate, even
I say that that issue was not presented.
And I appreciate that, but at any rate, that gets us back to the standard of proof here, in which it's Mr. Maltaylor's burden to establish either a Franks issue or that the information in the affidavit was clearly insufficient to find to support a finding of probable cause.
So why is there reference to the DNA evidence or to the scraping in the affidavit?
I believe
that it wasn't to make the inference that this was the guy.
I believe that this affidavit may have been used in two particular search warrant requests. I don't know that for certain. That makes sense. But I think that if you look at the totality of the circumstances in this case, we do have a substantial basis to believe that Mr. Maltaylor was associated with the deaths of all these women. And it takes a very careful sort of circumstantial look at the evidence. But in fact, each of these deaths is linked to the other in some fashion.
Counsel, footnote 18 and page 4. Footnote 18 of the dissent indicates, while the warrant issuing judge would not have known of the subsequent events, hindsight supports my conclusion that no probable cause existed here. No evidence of the murder was found at Maltaylor's residence, and DNA tests excluded Maltaylor as the person whose blood was found under the fingernail of one of the victims. Is that your understanding of the status of the record and so forth?
It is.
I noted some hesitancy. Maybe I'm wrong. But when I have someone stand up from the state and say, You know what we want you to do, court? We want you to find that in this case, on this affidavit, which means narrow, court, don't stray, don't be broad, because you're going to run into some problems. That's the way I interpret it. What are you afraid of if we don't keep it very tight and very narrow? And I need to know that if there is something that you're afraid of.
I'm not afraid, Your Honor.
Okay.
What I was trying to get at is I think a legitimate concern that some of the justices have had in the past with regard to, and what we should all be concerned about with the Fourth Amendment, is intended to preclude general searches. And so what the state doesn't want you to do is create a specific statutory or a specific exception to the rule that you can't use these search warrants on stale probable cause just because somebody is accused of being a serial murderer. You have to still have specific probable cause to search in this location. The staleness rule still applies, but under the circumstances of this case, we haven't violated that rule because that new information that says that they keep this stuff forever, they keep it in the face of intense scrutiny. And we all have a common understanding of that in the case of Jeffrey Dahmer, where the police went to his residence, returned the victim. One of his victims escaped, and he still hung on to those mementos. So in the particular circumstances of this case, we're still in compliance with that rule that probable cause cannot be stale. The other concern that I know justices have had in the past is a blanket rule that says, even if he's a serial killer, does that give you probable cause to search his residence? And the state is not saying that either, because in this particular case, there is evidence that James Moldtaler kept mementos at his residence. That being the woman that he was living with in 1975 who saw the scrapbook in his residence. There was also a particular name, James McDonald, on a piece of paper that was found in one of the victim's pockets. This same witness, Fairbank, saw a name with that piece of paper with that name next to the telephone in Moldtaler's residence. So we don't have to say that any time someone is suspected to be a serial killer, you can search the residence. We still want that additional piece of information that establishes probable cause to search that particular defendant's residence.
I mean, give me your best, as I'm sure you know, response to the question of why there is probable cause to believe that there are certain items at this location. We've got, you know, the 20 year span here, we've got a lot, a good part of that time where he wasn't even living here. If I recall the record, the first part that, you know, if these crimes were committed by the defendant, if they were, because he certainly wasn't living at this address at that time when the crimes were committed, is my recollection of the record. I might be wrong with that. So there's 20 years, if I'm right, that he wasn't living at this address at the time of the alleged crimes. If I'm right, there are years where he was not at that address. So why should these items be found in this location?
Well, first I would direct the court to the majority's response to that whole issue of residence and living there. Even while Mr. Moldtaler was incarcerated or in custody, the affidavit establishes that he probably maintained his residence at that Arrow Street address. I take you first to paragraph 43 of the affidavit, in which the detective is interviewing the woman who subsequently married Moldtaler. That would be Patricia Ostrowski. In 1975, she's described as the woman who lived with Moldtaler. She lived on that Arrow Street address in 1975. We have evidence then from previous girlfriends that he kept mementos in his residence, that being paragraph 37, paragraph 38, paragraph 41, in which she actually saw information, scrapbooks, in his residence. So if Mel Tyler is the killer, in 1975, when he lives in Arrow Street, he keeps his mementos there.
The dissent takes the majority to task for being, and I'm being generous, for being imprecise. And it says, hey, the dissent says, look, the record doesn't show that he was living, also troubling is the fact that Milwaukee Police Department reports relied on by the officer reflect that Lothar was arrested for the earlier offenses for which he was incarcerated. He did not live on Arrow Street. He lived at North Wilson Street in Milwaukee. And then further, even assuming Lothar once lived at the Arrow Street address, the affidavit contains no proof that he currently lives at the Arrow Street address. And the dissent goes on finding, taking the majority to task for all of these insufficiencies. Can you respond to those?
It's my recollection that on one point the dissent was incorrect. My recollection is that he may have been arrested at a different address, but I don't think the record suggests that he actually lived in another address at that date in 1975. What the record says, what the affidavit says, is that he lived there in 1975. Then in 1975, after the abduction of Deborah Whitaker, he's taken into custody. When someone goes to prison, you still have a place where you keep all your stuff. Milwaukee police records, which are records that courts rely on all the time for this sort of address information, established that he and his wife maintained that residence for 20 years. Mr. Maltaler has asked you to speculate that, well, after he's done all these horrible things, his wife would have left him, but there's nothing in the record to support that. To the contrary, she has this discussion telling investigators that he has choked her to the point of where she loses consciousness, and even after that behavior, she marries him. So there's nothing in the record to suggest that she ever left him. And then when you move to 1988, when he is now assaulting their daughter, that, again, is all consistent with that relationship kind of staying intact. When the police then do the drive-by in 1998, 3 days before the search warrant is executed, the vehicles in the driveway were his wife's and his daughter's. There's nothing to suggest that they were ever divorced. A reasonable inference is that you live with your wife, with your spouse. So I think that the affidavit does establish a reasonable inference that that was his residence, both in 1975 and now in 1998. And I think also when Mr. Maltaler's counsel talks about how tiny these objects were, the sort of mundane nature of them, the Mickey Mouse watch, the earrings, to me that supports the state's position. Considering, if you accept from the affidavit, which is really undisputed, that these items are something that is of vital importance to a serial murderer, this is one of the most important personal objects they might have. It's easier to hide something that is small. And if it's that important to you, you're not going to lose track of it. And where the affidavit is significant is helping educate us all, educating the magistrate who issued the search warrant about the fact that normally if somebody is suspected of committing a crime, their first impulse is to get rid of the evidence. With serial killers and their unique kind of social and behavioral characteristics, they are likely to do the opposite. They, rather than destroy it, they might hide it in secretive ways so that they don't lose this very important possession for them. And so I think a fair inference is that even if he knew that he were under police scrutiny, that he would have taken that opportunity to hide, to protect these important things. And now, 20 years later, a reasonable inference would be that he believed he got away with murder. Now it's safe to pull these items back out and to be to be revisiting your past. And so in this case, the passage of time may actually have helped the state establish a likelihood that he would have would find that the police would find those items at his residence.
We are dealing with the four corners of a complaint. We are dealing with issues of law.
Yes.
Sufficiency of the application for the warrant. Is there probable cause to believe that these items were located here given the passage of time? I'm not sure that this is a fair question, but it's a question that lingers in the back of my mind. What if that footnote 18 that I read was changed and it says, and it would say, no evidence of the murders was found at Moldauer's residence and changed in this way, and DNA tests excluded him as the person whose blood or semen was found on all of the victims. Would your legal arguments be any different?
No, because what happens after the warrant is issued is simply irrelevant to that first step. I'm not completely sure that this is an appropriate point to raise this issue, but counsel raised it in his argument concerning why we give great deference to issuing magistrates. And I was interested in preparing for this argument in reading, I believe it was in Gates, in which the court actually said that one of the reasons we give great deference is because reasonable minds may differ on whether probable cause exists.
I expect you to answer the question in the way that you did. Your legal arguments would be different. I'm just wondering in my mind whether your legal arguments would be less persuasive.
Well, I guess I'm not the person to ask, because I would say that yes, it is persuasive because they're just not relevant. And further, I think that the fact that the state is alleging that the affidavit does establish probable cause to believe that he committed each one of these murders, the fact is that the DNA evidence and the semen are only applicable to the fourth victim. So it may be that he killed the first three and not the fourth. Although the state would also like to point the court to the details of the affidavit in terms of information addressing Maltaler's assaults on his daughter. Specifically, at paragraph 59, Tricia relates what happened to her. Her father would, when she was naked, choke her out, but then it never says he had intercourse with her. It says that he rubbed his naked body against hers. And so the fact that there is no apparent... alleged the presence of semen in these other three homicides does not make it inconsistent with Maltaler's own pattern of behaviors. To the contrary, two of the victims were found with their shirts lifted up and their breasts exposed, which would be consistent with what happened to Tricia. I'd also like to point the justices to the portion of the affidavit in which talks about Maltaler's own statements. What he says is that when he can't get an erection, he wants to make the victims weak. So in strangling and choking someone out and helping the victims lose consciousness, he may never have had intercourse with them, and that would be entirely consistent with his own statement.
Can I ask you? What elements, this is a very long affidavit, I mean, you don't usually see them this long in a search warrant or in an arrest warrant. Which ones would, if one of these or two were removed, would destroy your case? It's another way of saying, what's your strongest argument? Or what are the factors or facts here? Chip it over, because you got a lot of stuff in here, and I think you'll agree that would be totally unnecessary. to do this. I mean, I don't know that you need every single person here. You don't need that the vehicle was parked at a particular place in 54, et cetera. I mean, there's a lot of information here that really doesn't go to establishing probable cause. Well, if we took out any of these, which ones can't you afford to take out?
Because it's a totality of the circumstances case, I'm hard-pressed to make that decision, other than to give you an answer. For example, what you just talked about, the one victim's car being left out in the street, that's critical to establishing, linking that particular death to Multholler, because when Multholler abducted Deborah Whitaker, he did so by pretending he was a police officer. That particular fact you just cited is relevant to establish that the manner in which Cynthia F. was abducted was similar to that with Deborah Whitaker. The car was left, kind of pulled away from the street with the window down.
Why is that going to show that this particular address has got items? At this particular address, he's got items that are going to tie him to that victim.
Because to get around the staleness problem, I think we need to have that paragraph that talks about the fact that they keep these mementos forever. And that is based on the premise that he is probably a serial killer. And the serial killer requires a series of homicides. And that's why each one of these is significant.
Let's knock out 43. Can you afford to knock out 43?
Okay.
Can you?
I believe we can. Because I think we
can or cannot?
Can. I think that if you get back to paragraph,
excuse me. See, I thought that was an important one. I thought that was, your client states that in 1975, they spoke with Patricia, whom Multholler married, and with whom he resided in 1858 West Arrow Street. That ties in with 76, which
right.
says your affiant states that Multholler resides at 1858 West Arrow Street.
I think that paragraph makes our position particularly strong, but
yeah.
I think if you take out that paragraph, we're left with paragraph 76, which states that his wife and daughter lived at that address. I think you can still make a reasonable inference that serial murderers will keep these mementos of personal importance at the place in which they live. And I think that you, as a court, can make a reasonable inference that someone lives with their wife. But I do think, I agree with you, that paragraph 43 really, you know, hits the ball home for us. I don't know if the court was interested in addressing the multiplicity issue. But the state's position there is, of course, that, first of all, that Multholler waived his argument that that the charges violated multiplicity. But he did so by entering pleas because this is not a case in which he's challenging double jeopardy as a constitutional violation, but rather as an issue of statutory construction. When he entered his plea in this particular case, the state amended the charging, each charge, to satisfy objections he had made previously in the court. That is, the state only charged images that he had previously not objected to. And under the concept of judicial estoppel, the fact that he enters his plea, gets the benefit of his bargain by the state dismissing the other count, when we're only looking at a statutory right here, really, that he has then waived any claim that he might have had, that the charges were multiplicitous.
Could I go back to the other part?
Sure.
I think Justice Bradley asked you to make the best case on probable cause that evidence would be in a certain place. I'd ask you to make your best summary argument on the fact that this is a serial killer.
Sure. I think the best way to do that, Your Honor, is to start with and put yourself back in the communities we were seeing in Milwaukee County back in 1974 and 75. Four women disappear, all of approximately the same age group. Their bodies are found within miles of one another in Racine County, with one exception. Two of those women were killed by strangulation. One was possibly ligature strangulation. We don't know for sure. Two of the women had their breasts exposed, and one woman had a ligature mark consistent with that of a handcuff. That's what the community is living with. Then in 1975, James Maltaler pulls, pretending to be a police officer, pulls a young woman off of the road, approaches her, puts a gun to her head, handcuffs her, and takes her back to his car. Now keep in mind that one of the other women who was strangled to death, her car was found abandoned in a street under circumstances similar to those of Deborah W. In then investigating this kidnapping or abduction of Deborah Whitaker, police begin to talk to people who have had relationships with James Maltaler. At least three of his sexual partners described situations in which Maltaler would strangle them or choke them to the point of unconsciousness, and at some point had difficulty in reviving them. One of the victims' purse was found.
Let me try to pinpoint my question a little bit more. If you were doing a profile of a serial killer, what is the evidence that Mr. Maltaler, or whatever his name is, fits that profile?
I'm not sure how to answer that without giving you sort of that blow-by-blow rendition of the affidavit, which I'm reluctant to put you all through, but I think that it does, the crimes are all linked. And his pattern of behavior, as witnessed by his girlfriend, his wife, and his daughter, are consistent with these deviant, they're deviant, so they're unusual, and they're consistent with what happened to the women that were killed. Then he interjects himself into the investigation, sending what I think the affidavit properly considers admissions to the district attorney's office, saying this man is the Southside Strangler.
Well, is the profile of this serial killer a young woman, 20s, early 20s? I mean, that's a response there's murder, but there's a sexual component ending up in murder. Strangulation.
That's correct.
Within a small area, relatively, or whatever it is, geographical area for the bodies.
Okay. He has an interest in and has saved mementos, or at least newspaper clippings, items pertaining to the particular cases under investigation.
Could I ask, was there evidence in all four murders that mementos were missing, or that, I mean, Mickey Mouse watches and diaries and all of this, was there evidence in every single person?
The one that the affidavit doesn't appear to list as particular pieces of jewelry is Cynthia F. But in each of the others, Susan, Wendy, and Sherry, there were particularly pieces of jewelry that were missing, and necklaces, things that would have had to have been removed.
Were these valuable?
Not necessarily. One was the Mickey Mouse watch. One was a macrame bracelet. In one case, there were social security card and photographs taken that might serve a memento value to the offender, but to no one else.
You tie him up with this profile of the murdered people by the moment that he likes mementos and that he's into strangulation.
Yes, and that he sent a letter to the district attorney's office saying that he was the person responsible for these things. In addition, he took
access to these women.
Right.
And one woman.
Right. Well, and there's evidence that he had specific access to one of the other victims. I believe when he was asked to describe what one victim was wearing, he ended up describing what Susan W. was wearing.
Familiarity or access to at least two out of these four women.
Right.
So you got this M.O., mm-hmm. and then you got some elements in his background that seem to fit it.
Yes. And his admissions.
And his what?
Admissions.
Not that he... Oh, that he might have done it.
Well, that and, again, I think the statement to the DA's office is pretty compelling. This, written in his handwriting, this man is the serial... Additionally, he wrote to one of the media outlets asking for clippings, and he was the one that described those particular group of women, and he described their deaths as murders, not as any sort of suspicious disappearance. He described them as murders. And that, I think, corroborates all of the evidence we have earlier that he did, in fact, keep scrapbooks.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Jensen, you have 5 minutes to rebuttal.
Thank you. And what I'd like to do is answer the court's question to my opponent here about what is the most important paragraph in the affidavit. And to me, that's an easy call. By far and away, the most important paragraph in the affidavit is number 68, which I've been referring to as the mementos opinion. Because even if you believe Mull Taylor is the killer, even if you infer that he's a serial killer, the only way these items are still in his house 20 years later, or likely to be in his house, is if it's true that serial killers tend to maintain these mementos. And if you knock that paragraph out, the whole syllogism crumbles, and there's no reason to believe these items would still be in his house. Should the paragraph be knocked out? Yes, it should be knocked out, because it says, Urifine states that based on his training and research, serial homicide offenders often take clothing, jewelry, and other property such as photos, identification, and so forth. That paragraph is completely without citation to any authority. And
but there is authority cited earlier.
There is what amounts to a bibliography. But there is no citation to the authority. All it would have taken is a footnote or even something that says, according to Dr. Keppel, who investigated the Green River Killer, in that case, the killer kept mementos. I think that might potentially save the affidavit, but there is no such authority. There's no reason, there's no way that the magistrate reviewing this can scrutinize the reliability of that opinion, the way it's written. Moving on to the multiplicity argument. When I read the Court of Appeals opinion, I literally scratched my head and thought that maybe I had missed something, because it says that the premise of my argument, you know, belies the conclusion and so forth. And I had to read it three or four times until I realized that what the Court of Appeals was saying is that, and this is from page 19 of the Court of Appeals opinion, thus it allows for prosecution based not only on the medium, but also upon each image conveyed by the medium. And once it occurred to me that the word image appears nowhere in that statute, did I realize that I believe I still am on the right track. 948.12 says, whoever possesses any undeveloped film, photographic negative, photograph, motion picture, videotape, or other pictorial reproduction. That is a laundry list of media. If the legislature had intended to outlaw each image, it would have been a very simple task to say image. I think pictorial reproduction is intended to include things such as cartoons, oil paintings, things of that nature. So, if you confine the analysis to the plain reading of the statute, whoever possesses any of these various forms of media, it makes it clear to me that the legislature did not intend that a prosecutor issue a separate count for each image contained in the media. And I think my argument that a five-minute film, which is pornographic in nature, probably has a minimum of 9,000 individual frames, which theoretically could be viewed individually or printed or anything of that nature, that even further compels the conclusion that was not the intention of the legislature. The state counters that by saying, well, the legislature itself said that we're attempting to get at this evil of sexually exploiting children, and I have no doubt that's what the legislature was doing, and that certainly is a laudable goal. But the reason drugs are outlawed is, I don't think necessarily because we're trying to protect people from themselves. What we're trying to do is protect the crime, the burglaries and the robberies to get money for drugs, and the children who are not being fed by crack mothers and things of that nature. There's a broader societal harm. And I think the same thing is true of child pornography. There is a broad societal harm in countenancing this kind of behavior from a person. But I don't think that transforms this statute from a contraband statute into some sort of a sexual assault statute. I mean, to put it bluntly, once the pictures are taken, or once the children are posed in something of that nature, the damage is done. I don't think there's any further damage to that child by reproducing the photograph and distributing it. What the harm in that situation is the broader societal harm. So I'd ask the court to find that the charging of Mr. Maltaylor was multiplicitous.
And if you should succeed, and you only want one count, all counts dismissed except one, then what do you do? Send it back for resentencing?
Actually, I think I made a mistake on that, Justice. It should be two counts because there were two discs.
Okay, and that's yes. One reason I'm asking, but the response still is resentencing.
Right. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes our hearing.